Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Rob Stroud, Vice President CA, Chair, Insights 2012, and Global Top Executive. Rob, you have an amazing background. I was just looking at your history of success, so thank you for coming in and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you, and welcome. It's great to be with you today.
Rob, again, you have this amazing background, as I mentioned. You are this globally acknowledged world leader. And I know you have this really important role for the ISACA World Congress, which is the Insights 2012. Can you describe that role?
Yeah, thanks for asking. The role of chair is to put the conference program and theme together. And with Insights 2012, what we're really looking to do is put together an event really designed for progressive IT and industry leaders that we're going to address, you know, topics of strategic level, not just the low-level stuff. There's many events around for that. You know, as chair, the key aspect here is to put the right industry thought and topic leaders together so that we can really develop strategies for, you know, the effective integration of the business and technology and help the attendees, you know, really grow in their understanding of the industry and the way they're going to drive their own organizations forward.
So in your role as chair then, what are the top five challenges?
Yeah, top five challenges. Well, you know, there's always some great challenges. Number one challenge out there, there's a lot of industry events out there today. And one of the opportunities here is to really create an event unlike any other event. So we're looking to differentiate the event. So, you know, number one is we want to be inspiring. So you've got to come up with, you know, speakers and topics and thoughts that are really inspiring and will have people going away just, you know, chafing at the bit to move forward. Number two is, you know, how do you be innovative? How do you really drive innovation? So you want to be constantly thinking outside the box, not the same old, same old. Number three challenge is clearly getting the right speakers in there, getting their momentum and getting their thought and their creative juices flowing. I think number four challenge is just, you know, getting on people's calendars. We're all so busy. All of us, we're just so busy in our day-to-day life. We're all doing more with less and continuing that growth. So we have to do that. Number five is going back to my innovation theme. Well, we have to deliver a platform and an opportunity for attendees to think about how to be innovative. Because if we think about it for a moment, leveraging technology for business right now with things like social, mobile and things like that, it's all about innovation and leveraging technology to grow our business rapidly.
So Rob, how did the ISACA World Congress evolve?
Yeah, and I like your term evolve. It certainly did evolve. It evolved from, ISACA has been in existence now for 41 years, and for many years we've had what we call an international conference, a gathering of membership from all over the globe. And, you know, now that we provide events, what we call our CACS events globally, what we decided to do was evolve the international conference into an event that would be designed for both business and IT, where technology meets IT, if you will, and to really go outside the normal realm of risk assurance and security professionals to help them elevate their craft, their vocation to the next level. So we sat down as a group and last year, for the first year, we launched Insights 2011 in a very innovative event where we actually really drove, you know, thought leadership out there. We tried to get the combination of the business driving IT and IT together. And so that we could talk not about aligning with the business, because, you know, it's too late for that. We really had to ensure that there was a molding or morphing of the business and IT growing together to drive value. And so the event came about last year. It was hugely successful. So we've continued it this year, and this year we'll be moving from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco.
So why San Francisco?
San Francisco at the moment is a hub of technology evolution. You know, if you look at organizations like Facebook, eBay, Zynga, and others, all based on the west coast of the U.S., it's a great opportunity where we're seeing, you know, technology emerge and a great, you know, space to sit there and meet. And also, San Francisco offers one of the aspects that any conference has to have today, and that is a great social location so people can mix their, of course, their intense work time at the event with a bit of social activity as well, and maybe a little bit of sightseeing. And, you know, San Francisco is just such a great place to do that. And it's fairly centrally a global hub as well. It's easy to get to from anywhere globally. And that was one of the other key aspects of picking San Francisco for 2012.
So for this amazing conference that you're chairing, and what are the themes for 2012?
Yes. There's a number of themes that we're of course going to tackle. And, you know, one of the first things I'll say right up is, you know, one of the themes is that we're really looking for, you know, the first theme to be, you know, the future starts today. We're clearly hearing in the industry that, you know, we're moving beyond the recession that we've had into a culture of, you know, innovation, collaboration, and execution. And I think in IT now, now, execution is really taken for granted. It's assumed it's going to happen, whether you deliver or execute in-house or out-of-house with your technology. Execution is really about collaboration with the business now, and then you need to apply clever innovation because cycle times are dramatically reducing, and I think that's one of the key aspects that we need to understand. The second thing is, you know, the second theme that we're looking at is keeping an eye on tomorrow. I think we're really looking to see, you know, where tomorrow is going, what's going to happen there. You know, as you execute today, we need to understand where the opportunities are tomorrow. And then, of course, one of the interesting sessions that I'm looking forward to on the third day is the risk of failing to innovate. If you don't innovate, and if you don't really look at innovation, then I think you're going to end up with one of those organizations that, you know, fail to innovate. One of the things we've clearly seen is that, you know, Fortune 100 companies, if they don't continue to innovate, they're not Fortune 100 companies tomorrow. So we have a, if you will, a clear eye on the future, and then with a, of course, some discussions on execution in the past. Some of the other interesting themes that we're going to be looking at, of course, as you move down a level, are creating a culture of intentional innovation so that it's part of your DNA or part of what you do. We're also going to be talking about information as a business integrator, which really gets onto the common concept at the moment of themes like big data and things like that. Of course, no conference with Osaka would be complete without some time spent on cybercrime and threat that are coming and threats that you're going to see in the future. And the piece I'm looking forward to as well is emerging regulations, what's coming and how they're going to impact the way we deliver IT. And, of course, you know, the other highlight for me is to put this together is, the Cobit Lounge, where we're going to have an opportunity with Cobit 5 launching next month. We're going to have an opportunity for people to get together with Cobit specialists and talk about how they can leverage Cobit as they go back to their job and really look to implement effective governance, risk, and assurance.
Now, you mentioned Cobit, and it's quite famous in a way, but can you quickly profile Cobit and the value?
Yes, and great questions again. Cobit, Control Objectives for Information and Related Technology, as it used to be known, has evolved over time, and, you know, as it's evolved through its framework now, it's really a business framework for enterprise governance of IT. And I think what we've, one of the things that we've done with Cobit is its value is in an organization. It really will help provide a framework for an organization to start with so that they can take their business goals and objectives and drive them into their IT goals and objectives and ensure that their IT delivery is constantly meeting the business requirements, both from a process perspective, from a legal perspective, regulation, of course, and just what the organization requires from a culture perspective. And, you know, as such, you know, it may have been in the past been known as an audit or assurance framework. It really has moved into a governance framework. And with Cobit 5, one of the key aspects is the separation of governance and management so that you understand your governance layer and how you effectively govern the environment. And then at a lower level, how you put enabling processes in place to ensure that you manage that constant governance environment without too much impact on the business or, you know, really in a seamless way is the objective. So as we move forward with Cobit 5, you're going to see that amalgamation of risk, value, and also assurance all come together so that you can effectively manage your IT environment.
It's interesting you're talking about, you know, the aspects of Cobit. What sort of penetration do you have amongst the global Fortune 1000 and then also amongst maybe medium and small business?
So Cobit is quite extensively used globally. globally, and we've recently done some research, more of which we'll be talking about at the event, on the use of COVID. But we see COVID used extensively within the, you know, whether you want to say it's the Fortune 100, the Fortune 1000, or 2000. COVID quite extensively used there to, certainly it's known in organizations as an assurance framework and a governance framework. Small to medium enterprise use is a little bit less, but we see going forward as people look to leverage outsourced and cloud services more, they're going to be looking for these assurances that a framework like COVID will support and provide. And I think, the key aspect of looking at COVID is to ensure that you don't you know, put such a heavy framework in place of process that you can't be innovative. And that's one of the things we're actually going to talk about a lot at the conference, is leveraging COVID effectively won't actually add significant overhead. It's actually going to ensure that effective processes are in place so that you can actually innovate and drive value rapidly as the business dictates.
How much overlap do you see then between COVID and enterprise architecture?
Great question. And enterprise architecture is certainly an art that more and more organizations and enterprises are looking at now as we study our information and, you know, the business needs and drive it into a structure or strategy for the enterprise to deliver. And COVID actually aligns very, very well with enterprise architecture. In fact, one of the things we've identified in COVID is that enterprise architecture is a fundamental aspect of delivery of effective, you know, business enablement leveraging technology. So rather than have overlap, we actually work and complement enterprise architecture very well, and with putting the right, you know, processes in place to ensure that your enterprise architecture is part of your DNA, part of the way you deliver. And that actually leads to a key aspect of COVID, is that it is a complementary framework to things like ITIL, enterprise architecture, so on and so forth. And we've actually leveraged well-known frameworks in those spaces as we've gone and developed COVID 5. And certainly ensured, I think the key word to use is harmonize. We've certainly harmonized COVID 5 with these frameworks, and especially enterprise architecture.
It's interesting then, you know, ITIL is quite well known, but there's a sort of new kid on the block from the Innovation Value Institute, the Capability Maturity Framework. Is there any integration or some kind of synchronicity with IVI and the CMF?
Yep. So we actually, COVID 4.1 CMMI had a very, very good alignment with it. And we actually had a process capability and a maturity model in COVID 4.1. With COVID 5, we've actually moved and adopted the ISO standard. We've adopted ISO standards for process assessment models. And what we've gone and done there is aligned each COVID process with the ISO model, so that we can actually have an accessible implementation of COVID going forward. And so what we've gone there is absolutely gone and done that alignment with the ISO standard. And I think that's a key aspect of where we're going in this world. So to go back with other standards, there'll be an opportunity post-COVID 5 for industry specialists to leverage the opportunity to look at, you know, mappings or alignments with other frameworks. So COVID generically, and the enabler model, or the process enabler model that we've delivered, will be very synchronized, and you'll be able to align it quite well with those various frameworks that look at capability and maturity. And it won't really matter where those models come from. So we haven't done that mapping work as yet, but that work will certainly be compatible.
You know, we just had a series of questions and answers in terms of COVID, and that itself is a lot of value that's been delivered at Insight 2012. Now, let's kind of broaden that. If you were to segment the attendees by their profiles or job roles, I mean, who should attend? And then what additional value will they receive by their profiles or job roles?
Yeah, great. So I think, you know, one of the key aspects is security professionals, one of the areas that we're going to be seeing. Security is a hot topic at the moment, and if you've, you know, been reading in the industry, you've noticed that right now topics like privacy and you know, protection of information and leveraging effective use of my information is a key and hot topic. So we'll see a lot of opportunities for security professionals. And what they're going to get out of there is an opportunity to network and interact with the industry leaders industry thought leaders to really talk about how security will work, how they can leverage it effectively, and how they can link it to the organizational goals and objectives. The second, of course, interesting role we're going to be seeing there is assurance professionals. We're going to be seeing, and you know, this gets back to ISACA's background, and we're certainly going to see a lot of people looking at how to effectively apply assurance techniques. And one of the key aspects that we'll be doing is the current president, Ken Vanderwal, will actually be hosting a panel amongst a number of sessions where we'll be talking about, you know, assurance topics and various aspects there. So I think one of the value propositions those professionals will get is how to apply effective assurance and audit techniques in this new world. The other area that I really want to touch on is risk professionals. Now, risk is part of our DNA. It's part of what we do every day. And risk is being assimilated into all processes at all levels within IT and the business. And risk professionals are going to have the opportunity to attend a number of sessions to discuss risk, risk profile, risk mitigation, or risk acceptance and how to leverage that. And once again, in industry standard or industry leadership techniques and processes from organizations who are effectively managing risk today, and I didn't say mitigating, I said managing deliberately, who are accepting and understanding the threats and vulnerabilities and working out when and when not to mitigate. I think those practical techniques and tips will be a clear takeaway for that group. We'll also, you know, look at what's coming next. So your average, you know, your CIO type CEO role. I mean, we do expect, and we did last year, say, sprinkling of C-level executives who are non-IT attend. There, we're really going to be sharing with them a lot of the future. We're going to, you know, dust off the crystal ball, if you will, and, you know, really share our thoughts into the future, where things are going. Now, you know, you can't see, you know, no longer does a strategy develop over, you know, 10 or 15 years. Now, that's more an aspiration. But the reality here is that attendees will be thinking about where they're going to go to in the next 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, what's coming down the pike, you know, and a key example of that, a practical example of that is mobility. Mobility is just absolutely exploding globally, and attendees will get the great opportunity to discuss mobility with, you know, industry experts and leaders. And, you know, liking to keep things in numbers, you know, in good numbers, the other area that's going to be quite interesting we're going to be touching on is we're going to be talking about changing operational practices and techniques as well. Glenn O'Donnell from Forrester will be holding a session on an emerging industry trend we're seeing, which is DevOps. And Glenn will be talking about DevOps, its application, how it's emerging in the industry, and sharing with a number of, you know, a panel that he'll be holding, a group that he'll be with on stage, and allowing the attendees to question and answer that group so that they can get feedback on where DevOps is going and how it can be practically applied. And that gets back to a theme right through the whole event. Unlike a normal event where you're, you know, PowerPointed to death or, you know, PowerPointed to death in short or long sessions, one of the key aspects of Insights is we make these industry leaders and experts available to the audience for question and answers time, for interactive conversations, both on stage and from the audience. And I think that's one of the key differentiators of this event over many events, is this ability to actually interact with the industry experts rather than be lectured at, is a key differentiator and a key takeaway that I really enjoy, because you can come with your questions, your themes, your thoughts, your aspirations, and run it off this group of industry leaders and see where the where you're going to end up.
Rob, I do a lot of interviews, and probably a common theme that I hear from really the top leaders in the world like yourself is the value of relationships. So I could see a lot of relationships being formed from this event.
Yeah, and, you know, how remiss of me to mention that. And I think, if I think, you know, the number one reason why I attend events as an attendee is actually the networking, the couple of key business cards I take away, those conversations I've had. You know, I can think through to last year's Insights event where I made several, you know, great industry connections that I've now kept in touch with quite closely. And I think this concept of you know, relationships, leading back to the fact that, let's be honest here, that the effective, you know, the effective skill that's really required now for an IT professional going forward is the ability to interact, the ability to communicate, the ability ability to really, leverage the intellectual pool that's out there, both, you know, virtually and physically. And I always find that connections made at these events, once we form that bond, carry forward and I leverage them quite often in the industry. So relationships are critical.
Now, you're the chair of Insights 2012. So in your mind, what five measures will demonstrate success?
Yes, so success, demonstrating success is there. Number one, of course, is going to be the that wonderful survey that comes away at the end of the event, and high scores there always help. But to get those high scores, the five measures that we need to use are clear. You know, number one is that attendees gain valuable insight at the event. They leave the event gaining knowledge, gaining connections, gaining insight. And I think that is a key aspect. Number two is an interesting one, that each of the attendees that leaves wants to come back. We're holding Insights 2013 in Europe and, venue to be named shortly. But, as we come back, you know, if you create this network or this culture of, you know, wanting to belong, wanting to attend, repeat attendance, you know, wanting one of the events that you want on your calendar is a key measure we'll be looking forward to. Of course, metric number three will be that the attendance is high and at the right number. Now, one of the interesting things with Insight is we're not looking for the largest conference in the world. We're actually looking to target an appropriate number of industry leaders to come and join us there. And that, is almost part of the key aspect of what we're doing, is that we can get that culture by having the right people there. And, I think that's a key aspect that we're looking for as well. A fourth measure is the fact that people will be entertained. You know, it's not enough just to have content. You have to be entertained as well. So, you know, some of the things we'll be doing is, you know, looking to foster, you know, I'm very excited about, our opening keynote session, which is the Future Starts Today with the Passing Zone. And, the Passing Zone are going to be talking about things like teamwork and work balance and aspects like that. And one of the things we started last year is we had people motivated and enthused. And I think that's one of the key things we'll be looking for is, you know, people walking through the corridors and smiling and happy. And of course, the fifth, and you know, these are in no particular order, is knowledge. People will walk away with knowledge, key knowledge that they can go and use. They can take back to their organization, practically apply, and drive value from this event. And of course, that's going to lead to item number six, which is word of mouth communication, or maybe social communication rather than word of mouth. Maybe it's the blogosphere and Twittersphere and Facebook environments where people will recommend that they come to this event in the future.
Rob, you made a compelling case to attend for really a large segment of the population out there, and I know I'd be really excited to attend with all the sort of value that you're delivering. Now, what about the future for the World Congress?
The future, yes. Well, we're talking about innovation and future and prediction, so I'll predict that World Congress 2013 will be in Europe. So there's my first prediction, which is probably a loaded prediction, by the way. As we move forward, what we're looking to do is continue to rotate the Insights event globally. So you will see it, each year become an annual gathering about the middle of the year in geographies globally. So next year we will be in Europe. And I think that's going to be a great event because one of the natures of the World Congress, one of the key things that we see is that we get a good population from all over the world. And that is one of the key aspects that I love, because the different cultures blend together to give you a different perspective on how technology is being used. Because, you know, not technology is not being leveraged in the same way everywhere. It's not, you know, sure, we all might use, you know, something like Facebook. But reality of it is that as each culture emerges, as each nation emerges, just different levels of technology are emerging as well. And I think this understanding of the cultural differences, breaking down of those barriers, and this is one of the opportunities of a global gathering such as Insight, is you have a global audience that gets together and meets together, that understands, you know, can get this a little bit more understanding in the differences between us all. So the future of Insights is the event is going to continue to move globally. Next year we'll be in Europe. Next year we're planning some nice features and nice uptakes. I think the other future of Insights is you're going to see more and more introduction of technology within sessions. You're going to see more use of various forms, and we may actually have a surprise for one or two this year as well. But we're going to be looking to leverage more technology interaction going forward, so that we can actually maybe share inside the room more real-time feedback, more real-time response, more real-time opportunities for Q&A. Now, this has been done in lots of different ways, in lots of conferences, but I think one of the things that, at Insights as we look to leverage technology is we don't want to forget that one of the key points here is the fact that the audience will have direct access to the industry leaders and luminaries that are available. And that interaction is a key aspect. And we if we're sitting in a room, we want to ensure that we foster that interaction so that that everybody can continue to interact. And one of the things I don't want to lose going forward, one of the things for the future, is this interaction, because that's where relationships are really built. And I think that's a key aspect of what we need to continue to engender as we move forward.
Rob, and surveying your background, you have some really key roles within the ISACA organization, and one of which is the Strategic Advisory Council. So how will you measure success on the ISACA Strategic Advisory Council?
Another good question. So the ISACA Strategic Advisory Council provides insight and knowledge and research back to the Board of Directors to assist the Board in making strategic decisions for ISACA moving forward. So, the way we really work within the Strategic Advisory Council is it's a opportunity for us to put a number of people together who've had extensive industry experience, extensive connections in the industry and ability, and also understanding how the profession runs quite well. And within the Advisory Council, one of the things we've really been doing lately is looking at our strategy and our strategy moving forward. So for ISACA, because it's an industry association where we of like-minded professionals in the risk assurance and security spaces and governance as well. I shouldn't forget governance, should I? And as we move forward, what we've really been doing is looking at our strategy going forward. So, things like, how do we provide effective guidance for our members on, things like emerging trends like mobility. It's an emerging trend. Use of social networks. I mean, once again, social networks are not something that you should be scared of. They're something you should leverage. So, we've really been looking at how we're going to set a strategy in place to assist the members. And then, in terms of a strategy and high-level guidance, and that's really the role of the Strategic Advisory Council, provide high-level guidance back to the board, back to the key committees, so that the organization, which is very much member-driven and individual, and members contribute, their intellectual property through a number of white papers, through, a number of frameworks and standards. We mentioned COVID earlier, but in the past we've had Risk IT and Val IT and other frameworks as well, and industry standards, so that we can give back to the industry. And I think at the high level, the Strategic Advisory Council provides that information back to the board. And ultimately, often our individual efforts are not really noted, because it's the group of the, it's really about us helping the board set direction. And like in all good governance models, we give the board input based on our industry experience, and then the board will direct, at a lower level, and then, monitor that execution. So Strategic Advisory Council, actually one of the key metrics is hopefully, we give good input, and the outcome of that will be successful industry standards, best practices and frameworks that our membership can ultimately use and that are very effective. And I think, it's hard to put a series of measures on it, but, it's clearly about contributing and giving back to the industry. And that's one of the things I actually enjoy about ISACA in general, is this opportunity to give back to this profession, which, I've been involved in all my life. And I think it's a great profession, and I've certainly enjoyed it.
You also have a past role as International Vice President of ISACA, and I guess one of the current International Vice Presidents is, Joe Stewart Rettery. I think coming from the same sort of region that you originally came from. So in your past role as this International Vice President, what surprised you?
What surprised me? So, being in past International Vice President, what surprised me? An interesting question. I think what surprised me was the interest in, things like industry frameworks and standards. I mean, I've known that, as you're probably aware, heavy background in ITIL for myself as well. But, one of the interesting things is that we've seen governance grow as a practice, as a area of interest. And one of the things that's truly surprised me, which is really interesting, is that many organizations I speak to who are, for instance, using Ithaca framework actually are not aware of it. It's kind of an interesting phenomena. But what amazed me, and probably a little bit too close to it, is the answer. But what amazed me is that organizations that I know are using Ithaca frameworks for intellectual property within their organization to grow their value, you know, typically what they've gone and done is leveraged it under something that they've named internally, like their internal standard or best practice. So what really surprised me was the lack of awareness of use of some of the Ithaca IP. Now, that was when I started. I can share with you now that the Ithaca IP is certainly getting more and more well known through a series of communications with industry analysts and press, and of course just practitioners. I think that's what surprised me the most while I was in that role. What interestingly though did pleasantly surprise me was the as you visit Ithaca chapters, the acceptance, the warmth, the comradeship that I could actually as a industry body was you know, I felt like I was being part of a family wherever I traveled, and even since I've been off the board, I've still continued to feel that as I visit chapters.
Ralph, can you describe some of your roles with ITSMF and then some outcomes from serving in those roles?
Ah, ITSMF was a great time. ITSMF, I was involved with the board of the US chapter for several years and then served on the international board for another 3 years. And whilst on the international board, I had the pleasure and honor of doing a couple of things. And one of them was being heavily involved in the development of industry standards or ISO standards and leading and coordinating the effort within the ITSMF group of grabbing all the members' inputs globally, collating them together, and then providing that for development of industry standards like ISO 20000 and the service management standard, and also ISO 19770, which is a standard for software asset management. And of course, I had involvement both with ITSMF and also ISACA in the development of the ICT governance standard, which is known as ISO 38500. And I think that putting a process in place so that you can collectively gather the input of a large membership body and ensuring that that process is vetted and then providing input. The legacy you leave behind is an ongoing process, and being involved in the ITSMF International, that was a key aspect of putting that together. The other interesting program that I was involved in whilst with the ITSMF was the development of a scheme for recognition of service management skills known as PRISM, which has now been put in place as well. Which is that scheme is, you know, continued, or actually went into production after I left ITSMF, but, that putting the initial thoughts in place. And the third thing and has been the growth of chapters, you know, the establishment of service management as a profession, the placing of ITSMF chapters in countries and regions so that practitioners could get together and meet. And these roles were, you know, kind of enjoyable over a number of years. The other and final aspect, of course, was the involvement in ITIL and the development of ITIL. With ITIL version 3, I was involved in multiple roles, including, you know, being on the ITIL advisory board, also serving on the, as a mentor to one of the books, and also a reviewer, and amongst that, key evangelist, would you believe, as the framework hit the streets. And ITIL 2011, which just launched, thanks to my involvement with the ITSMF, I leveraged a large part of my final time with the ITSMF on the ITIL 2011 project advisory board, ITIL 2011 being the latest update. So it's actually a very rewarding way of giving back to the industry. And I think, you know, once again, these industry bodies allow us to dictate, or not dictate is a bad word, but to give back to the industry so that we can drive value to the organization, to the industry, to the profession.
Rob, can you detail your prior industry executive roles and then some shareable lessons that you want to give to the audience and that they will find valuable?
Yeah, it's interesting. As you can probably tell from my accent, it does come from a little bit south of New York. You know, prior to one of the roles I definitely had in the industry was being involved in security for some time. As a, you know, person putting security in place, one of the things that I learned about security is that the effective security is, in many organizations, a bad word. It's considered a word that brings negative overtones. And I think one of the key aspects that I certainly learned while growing a security practice, working for a large bank, global bank, was that to make security a word that's there, you need to effectively communicate the benefits and value that security offers. And security is part of an organizational approach. It's part of your culture. It's part of your DNA. Security is everybody's job, like effective risk management. And the reality of it is you need to, like teaching a child to cross the street, you need to make security part of the subliminal thought processes that go on as you move forward and you learn that skill and you adopt it. And, you know, it's one of those things that you know, now concerns me as I move forward, is that effective education is the best weapon we have in terms of teaching, you know, our children, for instance, how to safely use the internet. And or apps or mobility or whatever they use today. So one of the key lessons that I learned in that space of my life, which has continued on, is that effective education is a key. You need to embrace and educate is the theme that I use. You know, you need to embrace technology that moves forward, not be scared of it, and then educate. Now, I don't mean education by sitting in a room and, you know, going through a class or a course that might be boring. You need to effectively educate and make it part of the way they do it. So you need to find ways of instilling that education. You know, that's one key aspect of the learnings. And the other interesting role I've had recently as being involved in strategy and innovation is that the world of strategy is an interesting one right now, in that I through all my reading and analyst work and thinking, cannot keep up with the changes in technology. The critical mass is such now that technology and technology capability is emerging beyond my realms of thinking, and I think it's probably true for many of us. And I think what we have to realize today is that technology for technology's sake is not an outcome. So technology is leverage to empower or drive the business and business opportunities and ways to do things, you know, more effectively, more efficiently. And a key aspect I've learned in terms of doing strategy going forward is, you know, really understand the business need, the business opportunity, looking for those, you know, areas where we can truly grow business opportunity. For instance, if you think about mobility for just a moment, right, and mobility and, you know, the experience of flying on an airline. Well, I can remember a paper ticket just a few years ago. And if you think about, and a few years ago, it's probably 10 years ago since I've had one. But if you think of the way technology now totally automates that business process, well, actually, there's more you can do with it once you've gone through the automation. Innovation, though, is not about automating. Innovation is about adding value. So, for instance, if you think about leveraging mobility now in a situation, I mean, I bought a ticket just yesterday to take a plane flight, and I did it on my iPhone. Now, that's a basic process. It's just an automated process. But it was interesting to come back to me. If I looked at innovation, innovation came back to me that if you talked about it, is based on my itinerary and intelligent analysis of my itinerary, the airline actually suggested a number of value-added services that they could sell. Now, if you think about that and you think about that intelligent decision-making, that's actually something that's actually going to add a lot of value to the organization. Now, within that, there are a lot of risks involved. So one of the key aspects I've certainly learned in my industry is that to be a good industry professional, we really need to get back to base relationships with the business. The business drives information technology, and the business and information technology is a capability that really enables the business to do more with less, that's for sure, but also allows the business to be more flexible, more nimble, more changeable. And I think that's one of the things we need to realize in this industry, is that whatever is the normal today won't be the normal tomorrow, and we have to rapidly innovate. If we don't innovate, we'll die. And that's a key aspect of what we're doing. Many of us are scared of change, and I think we need to embrace change. And I think that's the other thing I've learned in my career, you know, operations, security, innovation. You've got to be prepared to change. You've got to be prepared to innovate, re-educate, relearn, adjust your skill set. But all this can be done easily and simply if you're close to the business drivers that are driving this culture set in the industry.
Rob, you have a lot of exposure to different domains and lots of technology, a lot of business thinkers and technology leaders and so on. And you also make use of various resources out there. So I'm going to sort of mine that experience. What are the top resources that you use?
So, it's interesting. Top resources. So I do a lot of clear research these days with the analyst community. The analyst community in terms of understanding where they see views and where the things are going. But one of the new recent skill sets I've started to leverage extensively of late is themes that are happening within social networking environments. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at things. It's, you know, for instance, we'll use Twitter as an example. There's a lot of, you know, stuff on Twitter. I don't really need to know what time you're going to go and get your coffee and the fact that you're currently sitting in you know, Starbucks or Costa Coffee right now. Now, depending on where you are in the world. But I'm more interested in trends and mining that information to see what is in front of mind with these people. So that's a really interesting opportunity. Also, the opportunity is available in social media, so things like Facebook groups or LinkedIn groups or things like that, to actually start setting trends and theory. So one of the interesting practices I've been leveraging lately is the ability to almost hypothesize through social networks a theme or a theory and to see what comes back in terms of information. And that's an interesting opportunity there. So you've kind of got the positive leveraging of social networks. Of course, number three in this area of leveraging information is we've got so much information available to us, you know, in tools like Bing or Google by doing effective keyword searches. But all these things are good, valid data to really massage or validate this data. One of the things I've been truly leveraging, by the way, is establishing a series of hypotheses and then running it past a select group of individuals in the industry. So I'll go and, you know, I may do my initial pass through social network, type hypothesis testing, throw a message out there on Twitter, write a blog entry, do a Facebook post to a specific group, but ultimately need to validate that thinking with a group of people. So it gets back to plain old common communication. And I think I might say plain old common, but it's a skill that many of us are losing. You know, one of the things I will do is we'll go out there and talk to a large number of industry professionals. So I may go to an event like Insights, I should say. But I'll take an opportunity to spend that time in the social networking environment, sitting there and actually conversing with my peers. And I think that's another key aspect of looking at that. Of course, you know, all these things assume the usual suspects in terms of, you know, of information. You know, you read your blogs, websites, Harvard Business Review, so on and so forth. But I think we have such a powerful tool available at our fingertips now with social media that effective use and mining of social media can really give you good indications of industry trends and where things are going. But getting back to a former point I just made, nothing beats sitting down with a round table of industry experts or luminaries. And I had a wonderful opportunity in Europe just last month where I sat down in 9 different countries with a series of industry experts in a round table format, and we just conversed based on a series of trends and hypotheses for about 2 hours. And this group gave incredible feedback back in terms of what they were seeing in their own organizations, where their thinking was, where the business thinking was. You know, some interesting things came out of it, such as, you know, which are relevant right now to me, which is, you know, it's not no longer, you know, I talk about innovation a lot. It's not just about cutting the cost of IT. That's cutting the cost of everything's important. But, you know, the reality is that many CIOs that I spoke to on that series of roundtables told me that the business holding them accountable for execution on innovation in a nimble and I don't want to use the word agile because people immediately think of agile techniques, but they need to be nimble and ready to move because the business climate will move rapidly. So I think ultimately, you know, it's like any piece of research in being in a strategy role. It's about setting a hypothesis, testing your hypothesis, working out where it is, and then the ultimate piece that you've got to take is a bit of risk. And I think risk is the one thing I've learned in my career is that, you know, acceptable risk is a good thing. If you're just totally safe with everything you do, you're actually potentially never going to grow. And I think, you know, risk is a good thing when effectively leveraged.
What are some disruptive technologies that you see on the horizon and how will they have impact?
I love disruptive technologies. So one disruptive technology that's clearly come and gone is the iPhone. Or I should say coming and continuing to come, shouldn't I? But, you know, this whole concept of mobility is absolutely disruptive at the moment because it's disruptive to the status quo of IT. And I think we are only at the beginning of mobility. We haven't really pushed the boundaries of it at all yet. And I see, one of the things I firmly believe is the concept of the PC is, I believe the PC as we know it is dead. The old fashioned, you know, PC. And this is, and that's not a Mac versus PC type discussion. It's that the fact is we're quickly and rapidly seeing the fact that we're going to have devices that we're going to be using. They'll be PC-like, probably. Maybe something like an Android or a tablet or a iPad or something like that. But the value proposition here is not the individual devices, it's in the interconnectivity of these devices. And I think this is going to be very disruptive to the way we know it. Devices that can self-communicate, that can actually communicate to each other, can actually share information and have some form of intelligence in that decision-making capability. We're going to be seeing more of that. We're going to be seeing the fact that with mobility, your job will be wherever you are. And we see this in the culture of the new, you know, digital native generation, where the digital native generation, you know, the 18 to 34 year old, you know, Gen Y, as some people call them, these people have had technology their whole life. They're used to the internet. It's not a privilege. It's a right. It is a basic human right to that. And that's a great thing because I guess I'm a virtual Y-gen because that's the way I feel about technology. But if you think about it, they want to explore the boundaries. They don't want to be encompassed by a series of rules and requirements that say you will only use the work PC at work. So if you think about it, the boundaries are extending. The next disruptive technology that, you know, mobility is going to continue. And it's sort of connected to that is this consumerization of IT. We are clearly seeing, and I don't think this is a new thing, by the way, this is a trend we saw when the mainframe was, you know, kind of superseded by the next big thing, which was the personal computer, which then, you know, was superseded with the ubiquitous access to the internet. The next clear aspect there is consumer-driven IT. And it's interesting because the consumer today, the new consumer, demands choice. And in demanding choice, I believe that's where enterprises are going to have to rethink the way they deliver technology. So, for instance, if you think about it today, you have your standard applications that you use in your environment. Well, in the future, you will still have standard applications. But what about an enterprise that you know, basically has its own app store or that has its own, you know, solution stack? These are the approved apps you can use. And at the end of the day, you're going to be seeing a situation where the capability, the capacity may or may not be delivered within the organization itself. And I think, we've been talking about cloud computing for the last year as disruptive technology. Personally, the cloud to me is just yet another form of capability delivery. And, I absolutely think it's disruptive in some of the aspects to IT. But if you're a business consumer, you may not actually see it as disruptive. You may see it as supporting your business objectives to do things quickly to deadlines and so on and so forth. So you see those type of disruptive technologies and changing workplace, and it changes the IT discipline dramatically as well, because instead of having a totally controlled environment, you're going to have an environment you're going to manage. Now, the next disruptive thing is not necessarily a technology. I think the next area of disruption for us all will be legislation and regulation. And we've seen that recently with the discussion over privacy, and people have talked about the fact that, you know, you may have an app on your device, whether it's an Android or an iPhone or whatever it is, or an iPad or whatever, is, you know, what information is being shared. Well, the first instance there is the reality of today is that, you know, you've got to make a conscious decision of what level of privacy you wish to maintain. Now, if I think about my own life where I have a car with a, you know, system in it that you can track my car at any point in time, know where I am, has a number of embedded technologies. I think the next disruptive thing as we see embedded technology start to communicate is we'll get a situation where we'll start seeing more intelligence in technology and we're going to start to see it become more interconnected. Now, I haven't come up with the IT technology yet that will take my garbage can out to the curbside yet, but, in theory, you could actually probably build that, but the cost-risk analysis doesn't support it. But if you think about it today, imagine a scenario where, you know, things like, you know, technology which is available today, which is, you know, technology which determines if you're in a room and turns your lights off automatically. We say, hey, Rob, that exists today. It's a a sensor. Well, I think those type of technologies are now becoming price appropriate so that people can actually start to invest in it. So I think we're going to be starting to see intelligence and mining of information. So if you consider that's really mining of information, so that intelligent decisions will be made from the, you know, the systems that are around you on making preference choices, selection choices, and things like that. And I think another example of the way technology is being leveraged effectively for innovation is clearly things like, you know, if you think about, you know, your new automobile and you're going to buy a new car and, you know, you look at the fact that you can buy an option now which will do self-parking. I actually think that's a great idea, but I'm more interested in systems that are intelligent enough to know that you're going to have a collision and actually then take, you know, to some point they then interact and ensure that the systems in the car operate so the braking happens and maximum control happens so you can avoid the accident, so on and so forth. These embedded systems, as they talk to each other and communicate to each other and work together, are going to create a really disruptive environment, because I don't know about you, but I actually like to control my car. And if I'm going to have an accident, I pretty much don't want to hand control over to the car, even though it's probably a safer way. I want to, and I like to control it. I think that's a key aspect of what we're going to see moving forward, is these types of capabilities are going to change the way we act, which leads to cultural changes.
Okay, Rob, continuing on here, do you see specific challenges or opportunities that IT workers and businesses should embrace or in the future?
Opportunities in the future. There are many opportunities in the future. Future is full of them. And I think one of the interesting trends and techniques that's happening today is the IT organization structure. I think that's one of the things we need to think about long and hard in our organizations. You know, should IT be totally centralized, you know, I'll use the word controlling everything, or should, you know, IT be more and more closer to the business? It's an interesting journey. One of the things we clearly see is that a lot of IT organizations now are separating their, again, it's a cycle, like their development and operations part of the business. So your operations people will be one group just delivering capability, whether they do it in-house or out-of-house. And the rest of the organization goes to the business and sits with the business. I think one of the opportunities here that's clearly required is that, you know, IT and the business need to almost realize they're acting as one. So an interesting opportunity here is that this concept of what we call the enterprise project management office or program management office, where IT is just seen as one of the steps in innovation or delivery of capability. I think that's one thing that IT organizations and business need to think about, is what the right structure for the delivery of this capability is. Sure, you can outsource infrastructure or you can crowdsource or however you wish to source it. But a key aspect is what does your organizational structure look like so you're delivering the maximum value? And that gets back to culture. And, you know, I think culture is the key aspect that we need to think through. Organizational culture, organizational change. You know, I talk a lot about change, and change is something I embrace and accept, but not everybody does. And I think one of the other aspects that we need to think about and we need to leverage is the way we learn going forward. So if I, going back to, you know, disruptive technologies for just a second, one of the things that I clearly see is that the way we're learning or the way we're delivering technology capabilities changing. The days of, you know, large education are gone. You know, I effectively pick up a new app on my iPhone or, you know, app on my Android device, and I expect to be immediately productive the second the download finishes. The app needs to be intuitive. It needs to be self-contained. It needs to be no education required, or at the maximum, a very, very short YouTube video. I think this gets back to the culture change. So in terms of moving change forward, one of the things we're going to be seeing is that an adoption of change, rather than the Big Bang Theory where we throw it all in at once with a major release, we're going to be moving more to incremental change that happens more rapidly, it's smaller, it's easier to be consumed. And I think that's a key aspect for the business to learn and IT to learn, is that we need to deliver capability in line with the human psyche or the human capability to learn. And there's a lot of studies on that and there's a lot of thinking about it, but the reality of it is if we can do that, we can deliver that. It's not about options, options, options. It's about delivering the capability that someone needs. And this gets back to another change that's really opportunistic or available now, and that is that, you know, rather than describing or defining the requirements by having a series of experts in the room, we're seeing the capability of the best people to suggest enhancements, modifications, changes or updates or how to deliver capability are the actual consumers of the application or system or business process. And, you know, a great example I recently saw was I took a cruise and, you know, one of the things the cruise director got on and said is, hey, if you've got any ideas for the future of cruising, just jump onto the website and submit your idea. And this idea of cloud sourcing, of social sourcing the information, of social sourcing the ideas and changes is a fantastic idea. It's an idea that engenders, you know, belonging and, you know, the great ideas come from the team, and then you can certainly leverage that. And I think that's another thing we're going to be seeing going forward is this concept of crowdsourcing innovation, the understanding and having the population that's going to consume the business process suggesting it, and, you know, nothing better than the end user to suggest it. And I think that's another area where the business and IT are going to get closer. And as they're merging together or melding together in terms of, you know, working together, they're going to be going through this assessment process of these capability enhancements together, working together, rationalizing and determining what to deliver together, and then ultimately driving it to a delivered outcome.
Taking a longer view, then, what innovation should we be watching for, let's say, in the next 5 years?
5 years is a long time, as I've learned in this industry, and my wildest dreams may or may not be delivered there by then. You know, I'd like to say flying cars, because that's been the vision I've had since a small boy. It hasn't come about yet, but I think what we should really be looking for going forward is some challenges and interesting issues going forward. And I think the one issue that we need to be concerned about, the one issue we need to really think through as each individual needs to think it through, is the issue of privacy. You know, your life is no longer private, and that is either a good or a bad thing, or maybe you have a neutral feeling about it. But I think going forward in 5 years, this is, rapid change innovation is going to continue to accelerate. And the individual needs to be thinking through, you know, what part of their life they wish to be totally public and what part totally private. And I think, you know, I can't tell anybody what the right answer is, and I don't want to, but I think that's an issue that for 5 years from now, and if you think about the privacy concerns today, you know, one of the things I think through in 5 years from now is, you know, a reputation, you know, can be made over a whole life and destroyed in a moment. And I think one of the things we need to have a capability about, or one of the things I often think about, is we need to have the ability to certainly understand, like you would fix your credit record, that your online persona needs to be able to be corrected if it's incorrect, either good or bad. And I think going forward, the level of information, the level of mining of information is going to be, I think this matter is going to be come to a head in the next couple of years. And, you know, the challenge is if we don't manage it effectively with cultural support, then, you know, we'll get regulation to manage it. And regulation is always an interesting concept in that people will regulate to the letter or spirit of the law. The other change that's going to happen, or the other thing that's really happening, and I see it already, is that the world is becoming a smaller place. And one of the things I think we will see in the next 5 years is the ability for us to communicate in language of choice, whether it's English, Spanish, Chinese, Russian, it doesn't matter. And the person who is receiving the voice, text, email, whatever, will actually read the upcoming data in their language. And that's going to be a really, I think, great thing in allowing and affecting communications globally. It's also going to, of course, you know, as you move that forward, it's going to make the world an even smaller place. Now, I see that as an advantage, but, you know, also, if you think about it, then that's going to foster and engender, you know, more global travel, potentially more global trade, more global interaction with systems. And as you do that, that is then going to lead to the next component, which is regulation, which I touched on earlier. Every country has different regulations, different laws, different processes. And I don't know how we're going to solve that one, by the way, is that, I haven't thought about it too much, but, you know, is that, you know, you're going to have to allow in any system that you build in the new world to realize that you're probably dealing with a global economy, not a national economy. And, you know, as you deal with that, you're going to have to allow for that. And, you know, that's going to require some thought. It's going to require some decisions up front. as we go through and design business, you know, IT-enabled business systems as to what your market is, where it is, how it's defined, and how you leverage things like that. So it's a number of interesting challenges going forward. You know, it's a number of great opportunities, I think, and it's a fun time to be in this industry because I think, you know, I just think the realms of technology are, you know, going to be, you know, so amazing going forward. You know, as you look at it, you know, I was watching a 3D television just the other day. I mean, heck, I can remember just a few years ago where the only television I had was black and white. But if you can imagine that single TV that's 3D, or maybe even 4D in the future. Imagine that you have total spatial interconnectivity and that one device, as we see these devices merge together, you know, maybe you won't have a physical TV in every room. Maybe you'll just have a device you carry around and that acts as your total communication vehicle going forward. Who knows? It's the opportunity's upon us. And then, of course, it'll be how do we leverage it and how do we manage it and how do we effectively use it? And, of course, you know, how do we identify the electricity that powers these things, which is also another interesting cultural discussion that you know, people are thinking through now, is that, you know, as we go forward, we need to make the devices that we use more eco-friendly and you know, consume less power yet deliver more output.
In all the areas that you work, are there maybe two items that are, you know, let's say you would consider highly controversial?
Yeah. Highly controversial. The challenge here is two. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that's highly controversial clearly at the moment, in many, organizations is this, battle of, you know, do we give the business control to determine their own applications and usage and systems or not? That is clearly an area of controversy at the moment in some organizations. And I can give a couple of examples. One organization I was with just a couple of weeks ago has a concept that there'll be no third-party services used in their organization, there'll be no cloud used, there'll be no anything, and all IT decisions will be taken by the IT department in the fullness and completeness of time. Now, that's an extreme position, for sure. But the reality of that is that, you know, what's the business perception is that IT is too slow, won't deliver, doesn't meet the expectations of the business, and the IT is just trying to do its job and effectively empower the business, mitigate the risk, ensure the system's secure, ensure the change is appropriately managed, and so on and so forth. Now, I think this gets back to one of the concepts at the moment about ownership of IT and ownership of how IT is effectively executed. Should it live in the business? Should it live outside the business? Should it be insourced? Should it be outsourced? It's a really controversial area, and this controversy has been going on for 10 years. We had this total move to outsourcing and then insourcing. Cloud has once again brought that back again. And I think if you think about those concepts, they are indeed engendering controversy in the business. And, you know, one of the interesting concepts that I think actually helps solve that, by the way, is the fact that most IT organizations can't articulate to the business the effective cost of the IT component of the business service delivery. And I think that's one of the areas we've actually seen a little bit of interest in the marketplace of late, is that if I can't identify the cost, if I can't really tell you how much my contribution is, then how do I determine value? And a good example I often used in that one, used for that, was that in determining value in the banking world, one of the things the bank understood was the cost of a transaction. And that transaction had different costs, whether it happened in a branch, an ATM, or internet, or through a partner. And it's interesting, as you look at that, the IT cost or component was actually higher, of course, in a non-branch transaction because the effective delivery vehicle was, you know, all IT. In a branch transaction, you had a heavy premises, labor, and human cost as well. So if you think about it on the nature of it, you can think, well, I can reduce my cost basis by just actually reducing the number of transactions, but the business driver might be to actually increase transactions. Now, if you're communicating to the business that you know, a cost per transaction or an effective allowance per transaction for IT capability delivery, and then the business can look at the different delivery vehicles and determine the cost based on that, then they can make a clear decision on which vehicle to go with, and then you can effectively equate the investment based on the number of transactions. Very simple, easy to do, yet most IT organizations have a reluctance to do that, and that continues to be an area of concern. The other area of, interesting debate at the moment, and that clearly is one, is consumer devices being bought in by IT. And I think this battle is almost over, but I think it's, I think the battle is done and won by the, consumer-driven IT or consumerization of IT. But, I think clearly a lot of organizations right now still don't know how to deal with, staff bringing their own PCs, their own laptops, their own components. This is an interesting issue that organizations are trying to deal with right now. Personally, for me, it's a great opportunity to effectively bring processes in place so that you can ensure that staff are happy and competent. And I'll just touch on, I know you asked for two, but I'll just touch on a third one. And the third one right now is a cultural one, actually. And that is, how do we deal with this new workforce that's coming about, that's going? If you think about, the Y generation and some of their attributes, very positive attributes, right? If you look at this generation, their generational characteristics are different to the generation before them. And the Y generation, I would argue are as hardworking as any other generation. It's just their work practices are a little bit different, in that they may respect personal time a little bit more. They believe in often more openness as a generalization, and they believe in sharing more information, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn. And I think one of the controversial topics at the moment are how to deal with that, how to deal with the fact that the Y generation are very open in terms of their communication skills and techniques, their work practices. They, for instance, I have a Y generation son, and he prefers to, as I've written about many times, he will work just as hard as I do, but his work practices are different. He will, be in the office, say, 8 till 4. He always goes home and has dinner with his son, and then he'll be working again that evening. But, he doesn't want you to encroach on that 4 to 7pm window where his family is important. Now, they're controversial processes because some of us are still learning how to deal with it. It's an interesting topic, but I don't think culture's going to go away because the new Z generation, they're up and coming. If you look at them, an interesting attribute of them is they go to school, and I have a grandson who's starting school next year, and I can tell you right now, my grandson uses the iPad better than I do, and he's more literate. And an interesting story I often tell is, the other day I was with him and he looked at my MacBook and he started touching the screen with his finger, and he told me it was broken. And I think that's an interesting concept, is that, if you look at, they'll want to communicate with them, the Z generation, you're more likely to be told to read their blog or hit their Facebook page. So this is about culture. And I think culture is one of those big things. And culture is something that IT in the past has not had to deal with, as we've been automating. Now, as we're innovating, culture is a key aspect we have to deal with. We have to acknowledge it, we have to be aware of it, and we have to allow for it.
There's this kind of area that's, I'm hearing here and there, and that is, we need to have a better quality assurance of computing professionals, or we need to have them manage risk better, or they're in such important or have such key roles that managing risk is a key issue. They need some kind of defined path, career path, where it's perhaps in the computing area right now, it's quite fragmented. There has to be some kind of measured way of protection of public and of their clients. This then gets to this whole idea of computing as a recognized profession with measured or demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, recognized credentials of some sort. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's interesting at Isaka, to go back to Isaka, one of the things we've done is we've absolutely identified that, a code of practice is required in computing, that effective certifications and career pathing are required, ongoing evidence like a doctor would do that they are, or a CPA in the accountancy field is required. We clearly see these as key attributes at Isaka. So, and I clearly see them as well. I mean, one of the things that, I'm very pleased to do is I hold the two credentials, one in the area of governance and the other one in the area of risk management. These credentials have to be, assessed that I was the appropriate level for those credentials, that my career background supported it, that I got both the educational and practice or experiential evidence that I had indeed earned these capabilities or skills, or had demonstrated these, and then I have to maintain them as well. And I think one of the things, clearly in terms of risk management, you need to have demonstrated the fact that you've got a process that you can execute on, that you've demonstrated over a period of time that you can effectively execute on risk. governance is the same, and it's really as well as you know, in the assurance area. So ISACA, for instance, was known has been known for many years for its CISA certification in terms of the assurance area and internal audit area of IT systems. And I think if you look at that, I mean, the last thing I want is my IT auditor to come in and make a series of recommendations, which I'm going to be held accountable for, based on the fact that that person has no knowledge, no industry background, no skill set, no proven certification, you know, so on and so forth. You know, that person who comes in and does that work needs to be appropriately certified. And we've seen that at ISACA with our CISA certification. And, you know, this is no different to you going to your, you know, your dentist and having the dentist operate in your teeth. I mean, you know, if that dentist is not appropriately, you know, recognized in the industry, has the right credentials, hasn't been to school, understand the profession, isn't keeping up to date because practices change over time, you know, you can still go see that dentist if you like. You're taking a high level of risk, getting back to risk. And I think this is the same in the IT industry. We need to understand that IT professionals, whether you're a project manager, whether you're a risk officer, whether you're, you know, you're a governance professional, or even a systems auditor, you need to have the appropriate credentials, and this industry needs to be validated. And one of the things we look to do at ISACA is provide these certifications. These certifications are not just an examination, they are also required to demonstrated capability and ongoing education, so that your education profile must be kept up to date and must be ongoing. And I think we're going to be seeing, by the way, we're going to be seeing more of this across the profession as a whole. I think, you know, if you're a project manager now, you typically will have a PMI certification. And, you know, I think in the ITIL space, there are a number of certifications you can have as well. But I think as a whole, we need to ensure that the IT professionals have the appropriate skill sets, have the appropriate certification, and more importantly, have the appropriate knowledge. And that gets back to the issue that, employers need to understand that to get the most and maximum value out of their employees, they need to ensure that their employees' skill sets are maintained, that their employees' skill sets are, they are given the opportunity to do ongoing education and ongoing learning. Without that, skill sets cannot be maintained. Now, whether they do it on their own time or their employer's time, their own money or their employer's money, to me, is irrelevant. The fact is that skill sets must be maintained, kept up to date, and kept current. It's a cost of business, and it's a cost of, you know, being within the vocation that I'm in, for instance.
So, Rob, we're down to our last two questions, maybe a third, and we've got about 5 minutes left. The two first ones, anyways, are pretty long, and so I wanted to get your sort of insights about a sort of a candid discussion on merging technologies, and that is CIO versus CTO. And the areas to consider would be things like technology to grow revenues versus technology to increase efficiencies, the impact of business driving the technology decision, technology perspectives from the customer's point of view, are CIOs becoming a chief innovation officer? So what are your thoughts on that?
So it's a great discussion topic, one which I subscribe to. And the first point is I think we're seeing IT bifurcate clearly into, and depending on type of organization you are and type of culture you're in, gender, I think we're going to be seeing clear definition or delineation between the CIO and the CTO roles. Chief Technology Officer, I believe, is somebody who is indeed across technology, understands technology issues, understands maybe emerging technology, but at the same time is going to have a skill set that is linked to understanding business need and drivers, and effectively can match the business needs and drivers with technology capabilities available in the industry, and then can direct appropriate, or give advice and direct how to execute on that. CIO as Chief Innovation Officer, I love that that changing that role. That role, you know, in a lot of organizations, CIO has been, you know, placed in a role of just being a vendor manager, where they sit there and understand some capability requirements, go out and do an RFP, place it, and then manage against that RFP. Chief Innovation Officer is really going to be looking then to drive innovation, to drive, you know, to drive value back to the business, to look for innovative solutions and really partner with the business in driving that innovation. And I think going forward, we will see both both exist. We will see effectively CIOs who are just effectively procurement management, who are procuring capability and delivering it and measuring against it. We will see CTOs who are truly technical in their careers and they'll make those decisions to go down that path. And we'll see the true CIO, the chief innovation officer, move out of IT as we know it, probably move into a role that is reporting direct to the CEO or business leader, where they will be, and he or she and their team will be driving innovation and just leveraging technology to drive business innovation. As I mentioned earlier, the notion of the enterprise PMO, where IT is just one component of innovation moving forward. That's clearly the industry emerging trend, I think, that appeals to me at least the most.
The second part of this question is in terms of governance and board insights and some of the discussions that could occur amongst board members. So for example, what would be the board's top concerns as it relates to the integration of technology and business? And who do board members rely on within the organization? What's the issue about deploying an IT governance program in the board and innovation and its impact on the organization's future success and preparing the workforce for the future? What are your thoughts on a board-level discussion on some of these issues?
Wow. Great question. And once again, if one of the things we did and we've acknowledged is this growing industry trend, you've got to separate governance from management. Management is about the execution of the tasks that have been directed and ensuring that, you know, continuous controls are put in place to ensure effectiveness and efficiency of the systems that deliver capability. Governance is really about evaluating, you know, directing and monitoring. And I think at the board level, the board needs to, and, you know, in many boards, they want to get into, you know, nitty-gritty discussions from time to time, and you know, that is part of their charter, should they wish. But I think effectively, you know, as we look at this, technology is one of the execution vehicles available to them for business innovation. And the board, clearly, I think, you know, one of the things the board is looking to now, and boards are becoming more briefed, more well-versed on technology opportunities. There's no doubt that, you know, if I mention the word or the term, you know, I mentioned one of the home known ERP systems, you know, SAP or Oracle at a board level, they would know. I have an idea of what it is, have an, you know, at least a mind picture of what it is and where the value proposition is. You know, they might just view it as something we have to manage our finances. But the reality of it is, as we move forward, I believe the boards are going to become more interested. And your previous part of the question was talking about the chief innovation officer. I think boards are more looking to briefing from people like chief innovation officers, CTOs, on technology capabilities to become more conversant with opportunities that are out there for them to take advantage of. Now, that doesn't mean they need to become technical experts, but boards, I believe, want to know that capability. And then boards want to then effectively understand all business initiatives that are going on that are high profile, high risk, high impact. In fact, part of the board's role. So, for example, if your business is totally dependent on its website because you're an online business and you drive all your revenue online, then a major change to the website, a major project that's going to change it, is probably a project that the board will at least want to have oversight and view into at their board meetings. And they will certainly want to know if thresholds are violated. This is where effective governance comes into play, where those appropriate metrics are rolled up that the board can see, that the board needs to know about, and where, you know, issues outside the status quo, outside of, you know, the green dots on the red, yellow, green chart, where something is not green, the board clearly needs to know about it, and they need to know about it in a time that they can take positive action, make a decision to continue, decline the investment, whatever it is, or, you know, exit. And that's what a board's role is, oversight. And oversight requires good information, which requires effective governance processes, and those governance processes should, of course, be monitored. And I think that's been one of the challenges we've had in the past. Many of us have had great governance process, but if we don't monitor them, it's little use. And I think that's the key aspect. And you know, the warning's got to be there. We've got to have the right threshold when things go to the board. Because, you know, it's the story that many of us had as a child. If you, you know, the little boy who cried wolf, if you say there's a wolf there every day, one day when there is a wolf there, you may not be believed. And that's the day you need to hear it.
Rob, there's just so many additional questions I can ask. I'm hopeful that maybe we can do another follow-up interview, perhaps post Insights 2012.
That'd be great. It's been a very thought-provoking interview for me, and I really enjoyed the chance to share my thoughts, that's for sure.
Well, I know your schedule is very demanding, and you are a globally recognized top executive thought leader. You've done so much in terms of contribution to the industry, to society, to the global industry overall, as I mentioned, and also to corporations, just with all the executive roles you've had, and just amazing impact. So thank you again for sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
Thank you, and thanks for having me today. It's been wonderful.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Rob Stroud, Vice President, CA, Chair, Insights 2012, and globally top executive.